В Москве на выборах мэра лидирует Сергей Собянин.
По данным столичного избиркома, Алексей Навальный отстал на 24 с лишним
процента. Алексей Навальный, Сергей Собянин.
И Кремль, и мэрию Москвы отказаться от
выборов не признаем. Собянин.
В России родилась большая оппозиция.
Они боятся назвать меня и называют меня некоторые политики. Меня зовут Алексей Навальный. Я иду на выборы мэра Москвы вместе с вами.
It was a campaign that upended the rules of political engagement and energized a generation in the Russian capital. And it was an electoral performance by the country's brightest rising political star that exceeded even the most wildly optimistic projections. Alexei Navalny surpassed all expectations with his strong second-place finish in by coming within a handful of contested votes of forcing a runoff against pro-Kremlin incumbent Sergei Sobyanin. But let's face it. There was no way the regime was going to let that happen. And guess what? I don't think it matters. Sobyanin may have kept the keys to the mayor's office, but Navalny appears to have taken home something much bigger, the future. Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, all.
And from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean.
It's good to be back.
And it's good to have you back. And also joining us via Skype from Storrs, Connecticut, my home state, is Kevin Rothrock, project editor of Russ Runeck Echo at Global Voices, author of the blog A Good Treaty, and an indispensable observer of the Russian blogosphere. Welcome back, Kevin.
Hello. You're too kind.
I'm not often accused of being that. All right, we've all watched this in real time. We've had a week to obsess about it. We've written about it, talked about it, tweeted about it till our fingertips hurt. So let's just cut to the chase. Who won in Moscow on September 8th? What did they win? Who lost? And what did they lose? And Sean, I want to start with you since you had a pretty provocative post this week arguing that, well, everybody won. Sobyanin won, Navalny won, the Kremlin won. You care to explain that?
Yeah. I mean, the purpose of the article was to remind everyone what this election was made for, what the purpose of it was, right? And I think the purpose was really about providing legitimacy to the system. Yeah, it was about getting Sobyanin reelected, and certainly for Navalny, it was about testing to see if he actually has any electoral constituency, which it turns out he does. But really, I think, you know, based if you consider the reforms at the end of Medvedev's presidency to allow easier party registration and to return these elections. I mean, the fact that there was an election was thanks to that reforms to the federal cities and governors. This was really the first test of those reforms. And it was interesting to see that the Kremlin wanted a fair election, a smooth election, and they wanted Sobyanin, or at least Sobyanin himself, wanted to be reelected. They certainly didn't want to wait till 2015 where he could, become unpopular. So this was the time. And I think that this was an important step for the Kremlin to see, to kind of test their political system to see if it can have some sort of electoral legitimacy. And by all reports, the election was probably the fairest that Russia has seen, at least in Moscow. And I also think we should remember that the fact that Navalny ran because of Sobyanin's patronage. I mean, you know, he was convicted and by all intents and purposes should have gone to prison. But because Sobyanin wanted this test, at least for himself personally, he stepped in along various points in the campaign to prevent Navalny from being kicked off the ticket. And I also think, and this is a stretch at this point, but the Kremlin needs a new political foil. One of the things that this election showed, at least in Moscow and the regions, it's somewhat different, that the KP, the Communist Party, Just Russia, and the other systemic opposition are complete spent forces. And here, perhaps Navalny and the street opposition allowing them into the electoral game allows for that foil the Kremlin needs to maintain the legitimacy of its electoral process.
And I must admit, it was provocative. It got me thinking because I was and am kind of on the Navalny gave the Kremlin a bloody nose bandwagon. And the question I asked myself after I read this is like, all right, if this is a win for the Kremlin, you have to ask this question. If they could do this again and get this exact result, knowing they would get this exact result, would they do it?
Well, it's certainly they didn't want it this close, right? But at the same, they're caught in a position, right? Because they have to have the election has to appear fair, mm-hmm. right? So they can't put the pressure too much. But at the same time, they don't want to get it so close. They don't want a second round for sure. Absolutely.
A second round is absolutely unacceptable.
So, yeah. So I think that they at least padded things a little bit enough to not make it look too suspicious, but enough to kind of put insurance on the fact that
32,000 votes. That's all it came down to.
And instead of, you know, I think this is an extraordinary moment for the Kremlin, its ability to go through elections because they took a softer line. And so far, we haven't seen any kind of, you know, we'll see over the next weeks and perhaps months how the Kremlin will actually deal with this fact. But as it stands now, they let it go.
Yeah, they took a softer line and they took a pretty close shave here, probably
sure.
closer than now. I want to address two other things.
Oh, yeah, one thing I want to say, though, that one thing that was, I think, surprising that they didn't expect was the low turnout.
Yeah, and
I think this was the main difference.
And for the low turnout to work in Navalny's favor.
Exactly.
And this shows me one thing. Anybody that watches election knows when that happens, well, it shows you which side of the electorate's energized. And I think this, mm-hmm. that answer was loud and clear here. So I think the good result with the low turnout actually says a lot about Navalny's strength because it shows that his base is energized. Now, there's two other things here, though. They wanted to get a legitimate election under their belt, and Ksenia Sobchak had a hilarious tweet. When officials were coming out saying this was the cleanest election ever, what does that say about elections before? You know, there was somebody, I forget who it was, somebody tweeted when Putin said this is the cleanest election ever, said Putin just delegitimized his own election because what does that say about his own election? The other thing is I agree with you, they need a new foil. That a just Russia, the Liberal Democrats and the Communists just don't really cut it anymore. And they got one. But have they created a monster? I mean, I'm not sure they can control this. And Navalny's playing his own game. And anybody that watched his speech on Bolotnaya, you can walk away with no other impression that he's playing his own game.
Yeah, but he's also, if I may interrupt, he's also been brought into the system. Now his aspirations are much larger. He's no longer just a regular kind of street oppositionist who's going to, you know, he could certainly go to rallies, but his main focus, if he wants to go to the future, is as electoral candidate.
Yes, go ahead.
This is a constraint politically, as much as it's an opportunity.
Yes, but I would argue the accent is an opportunity, but we'll see. But this isn't Mironov. This isn't Zhirinovsky. This isn't Zhuganov. This isn't somebody that's going to play by these rules. And once he's in the system, I'm wondering if they've created a monster they can't control, because it does appear, if you read between the lines of his speech, that he's going into the system on his own terms. That's the way I read that whole thing. Mark, last week we agreed that if Navalny got 20%, it would be a huge victory. When I said he might get 25, and no, I'm not magnanimous enough to let this go, you said no way. So what the hell do we call 27, almost 28, by the official count?
Well, I certainly don't think you're too kind. I think the key point, as you mentioned, was about turnout. I mean, what really happened is essentially that a very high proportion of Navalny's supporters actually went and voted, and a fair number of people who either they're the usual sort of dragooned public sector workers and pensioners, or who just generally sort of thought the things were going okay, didn't bother voting. It was a pretty low turnout, and certainly had it been a higher turnout, we would have seen Navalny's share of the vote shrink, because I think that's fairly inelastic at this stage. So that's really what I think sort of shifted the balance. Because let's face it, I mean, first of all, Sobyanin himself, he seems to be a competent city manager. But when people write his epitaph, I don't think the expression "a surfeit of charisma" will in any way make it into that. It was a fairly clumsy campaign that sort of tried to shift from making a virtue of not being political into at the last stages actually trying to be a political campaign, and therefore really managing to do neither. They didn't use the full panoply of administrative capacity at their disposal. Again, I think in part because they were looking to make this as legitimate seeming an election as possible. And finally, I think that a lot of supporters, because they knew that he was going to win, just didn't bother voting. I think we have to have some caution. It's not actually as if we can extrapolate from this particular result to say something about, I don't know, that 27% of all Muscovites think that Navalny is sort of, you know, a fine individual. But definitely, I mean, to go back to that point, I mean, yes, there's no way of getting around the fact that this is actually a really very, very good result for Navalny. But I just want to kind of riff off something that Sean was saying. I think we are seeing, at the moment, the Kremlin's still experimenting with a different mode of ruling. A mode of ruling in which they only need 51% rather than regarding it as an act of political machismo to have some sort of massive and overwhelming majority. So in some ways, we're moving from an era of electoral totalitarianism to electoral authoritarianism. Not trying to run everything, they're not trying to control everything, they just want to make sure that they're in power. And if it means that we end up with a sort of a model almost like the way that the Christian Democrats in Italy and the Liberal Democrats in Japan were able to rule for decades, which is that there's elections, there's the appearance of competition, but somehow one way or the other they always get just enough to be in charge, they could probably live with that. Now, you know, I'm not sure how sustainable or how workable that'll be. But I mean, I do think that from the Kremlin's point of view, this is much less of a disaster than if it had been under the old model in which they just wanted to sort of demonstrate that just they were unassailable and unchallengeable. All they want to do now is just win enough.
Or survive. But I mean, God, if we're going to, you know, Italy under the Christian Democrats or Japan under the Liberal Democrats, we're talking about Russia here. That is a sea change. And if that in this very modest place we might be going that you just described, that is a sea change. And if that's not the case, I mean, this is a remarkable victory for Navalny if he forced that.
It's less of a sea change, though, than it might seem. I mean, in a way, the issue is that under the old order, sort of Surkov had created this systemic shadow opposition, this faux opposition, but it had never really been used properly. Yes, there were the Liberal Democrats and the Communists were allowed to run and so forth, but there was still this emphasis on the party of power had to be seen to be, you know, not just victorious, but completely triumphant. So they'd never really activated that process, but it had nonetheless the seeds of it had been there, you know, had been there for a long time. So yeah, I think, you know, I suppose I'm trying to sort of, as ever, tread some middle line here.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying that it's irrelevant. I'm not saying, well, Sobyanin's won, end of story. Of course not. This is a definite shift. But on the other hand, I think before we start saying that Russian politics have been or are even being rewritten, I think we need a bit of caution, not least because we still need to see whether or not Navalny is able to translate an ability to bring in a very strong share of the vote in Moscow, but nonetheless, you know, a minority of Muscovites. Can he translate that into outside Moscow? That, I think, for me, is going to be one of the key
things. That is a key question, but it is also very telling that he was polling 1-2% when this whole damn thing started, and he ended up with 27. And that's and regardless of the turnout, that was the result. Mm-hmm. You know, because you can only have the turnout you have, right? Even in Russia.
Sure, sure. But on the other hand, again, but I mean, and there's no question, and we talked about this all, you know, is that by allowing him this election, the Kremlin gave Navalny a platform in which he can then demonstrate his undoubted political skills. So no question there. But again, we have to think about, well, okay, where did Navalny get these votes? And largely it's from cannibalizing the fake opposition. So in other words, there were lots of people who voted communist or whatever because they wanted to vote against the Kremlin. And in a way, the communists seemed to just simply be about the only sort of option in town to register a protest vote. Well, now Navalny has become the lightning rod to whom all these various mm-hmm. forces can go. So that's really important. But still, he has to move beyond just simply cannibalizing the opposition. He has to, A, galvanize people who up to now haven't been political, which, you know, there is evidence that he can do if he can get his voice out. And B, he has to then also move into actually taking votes from people who up to now have been willing to support the government.
So who won and who lost, and what do they win and what do they lose? What do you seem to think, like Sean, that everybody won?
No, I mean, Navalny won. In more constrained terms, Sobyanin won. Quite possibly this was massaged over the 50% sort of boundary. But nonetheless, actually, for an uninspiring politician who ran an uninspiring campaign, he did, I would say, quite well. And certainly, of all the various figures within the world of the Kremlin technocracy, he now, you know, actually can some degree of legitimacy in a way that no one else can. Mm-hmm. And did the Kremlin win? I mean, I think I appreciate the polemical value of suggesting that. I don't think the Kremlin won here in the sense of legitimacy is far harder to win, and I think it's Sobyanin rather than the Kremlin that got legitimacy. But on the other hand, I think the Kremlin has so far managed to avoid losing, which I know sounds like it's kind of playing, but I mean, I think the point is that at this stage, this is not an insurmountable obstacle. This is not being holed below the waterline. Use whatever image you want. No, there is still the possibility that Navalny will either find himself house trained, or just simply be unable to spread his message beyond Moscow, and therefore will remain, an interesting figure within the political scene, but not a challenge. But nonetheless, yeah, I mean, if we're going to talk about who's a winner, it's Navalny.
I would have to agree with that. And before I let Kevin shoot me down, I'm going to give my take on this. I mean, I wrote about it on the blog this week a bit. But basically, Navalny won. I don't think Sobyanin won. I think Sobyanin is the biggest of the three losers in this. And why do I think that? Because this election was also about the internal clan. It's about court politics as much as it was about public politics. Sobyanin wants to be the successor. He didn't really help himself out with 51.37%, was it, of the vote? I mean, really, coming within 32,000 votes of a runoff against somebody that was polling in single digits a couple of months ago, I don't really think he helped his case in making the case that he's the successor. Sergei Ivanov is a winner here, is a hidden winner in here, actually, and others that are vying to be the successor. Rogozin and Ivanov, I bet, are pretty damn happy with this result in some ways. Well, they're probably unhappy in other ways. So I would say Navalny's the unambiguous winner. Sobyanin's the unambiguous loser. The jury's still out in the Kremlin. I'm not quite sure, but I'm tending to think that they got a bloody nose. But Kevin, reel me in. I mean, Kirill's not here today, so I need you to give us a dose of that refreshing skepticism of yours.
Well, as long as it's skepticism and not cynicism.
No, I've never accused you of being a cynic. You're a skeptic.
So the question, who won, who lost, what did they lose?
What did they lose, what did they win?
I mean, everybody's asking themselves this. I've asked myself this. And ultimately, I think it's kind of a silly question. I mean, the results are that Sobyanin won 51% and Navalny won 27%. And that's who won and who lost. Now, in terms of what is the significance for the fate of Russia?
In the
or
big
for
game, not just this election, the big game.
Right, I understand. In that case, it all depends on what people do now. Because the results themselves, they don't decide anything. If Sobyanin wants to make a play for whatever, he can still do that. I mean, his power, I suppose, or his reputation as a politician is diminished, but you don't lead Russia by being the most charismatic politician. You win by pulling the right levers. Now, Putin became charismatic, but that's not how he got in the seat. So in terms of does this close the door forever on Sobyanin to become leader of everything? I don't think necessarily. Also, haven't seen necessarily evidence that that's what he wants to do or that that's what people want for him. And so there's too many things that will decide that for this one electoral contest to have made anything definitive on that end. Now, in terms of there's sort of been a lot of discussion of if this is a victory for Navalny, then what is the significance of that? And then people start talking about systemic changes in Russian politics. Navalny's one guy, and the best way, I think, in a single word to describe his campaign is that he's a populist. He might as well have gone out on those stages or stood by his cubes with a broom talking about cleaning up politics and so on. Now, that doesn't strike me as terribly revolutionary. I know when we listen to him, first of all, he's a great speech giver, like any good populist, and his rhetoric is very sort of vicious at times, and so it gets your blood boiling. I mean, even when the podcast just started and you were playing excerpts of his speech, I mean, like, your heart starts to race.
No, I just listened to his Bologna speech again before this podcast that I was picking out cuts, and it does get your pulse up.
Right, but that's not systemic change in Russian politics. That's one guy who's good at giving good speeches. And he talks about his what this campaign means is that there's basically a new vanguard in the opposition and in the opposition at large, not just the non-systemic opposition, but the systemic and the non-systemic merged together. He's going to be the vanguard. His people will lead everyone to the bright tomorrow and so on. I mean, that's really the way the rhetoric sounds. I'm not trying to be sort of I'm not trying to mock him. I think that's actually what it sounds like. It's populism, and that there was always room for that in Russian politics.
Funny how when you're talking, I'm hearing birds chirping outside, and when Mark is talking, I'm hearing sirens. It's
Connecticut,
Brooklyn,
versus New York.
Brooklyn in stores, man.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm not sure that there's a very good answer for the who won, who lost question, because I really do think that it all depends on what people do now. Now, if you look at Sabyanin's reaction the night of the election, when the results were more or less certain, but they hadn't quite come down definitively yet on his first round victory, he went out and gave a very awkward speech to a technically legally gathered crowd, and it was horrendous. Like he's just not a good public speaker at all. And Navalny's speech in comparison, I mean, it just doesn't work to compare them on these levels. And Navalny's campaign released a lot of claims about the dishonesty of the election, none of which I think are terribly persuasive. And I think he's really grasping at straws. There's even actually – he released a post a few days afterwards directing someone to a random post by a Russian blogger who had done Gaussian curve of Sabyanin's – of the turnout versus his support that basically showed that as turnout increased after a certain level, his support went down, which is basically evidence of a sort of standard honest election.
Yeah, but his main complaint was the home voting, which is supported by Golas and other independent observers. I mean, he's got – we're talking about 32,000 votes.
No, and, I understand. But what I was going to say is that the post that he was linking to, he was linking to it to show – The argument he was making is actually contrary to the one that we've raised here, the idea that Sabyanin's main electorate didn't turn out, his constituents didn't turn out. Navalny was arguing that, actually, the more turnout there was after a certain level, Sabyanin's support went down. Therefore, we didn't turn out enough people. Our supporters stayed home. We need to be more vigilant, et cetera. But later in the post, you have this Gaussian curve stuff, this stuff proving that the elections were actually quite honest. So I'm just I raise this just to say that this is the essence of Navalny's sort of post-election self-defense, is to link to posts that actually argue for that fundamentally argue for the honesty of the election, and then there's sort of a technicality about turnout versus this or that. But what I mean to argue is that Navalny is kind of what he's come up with in terms of disputing the election in the immediate aftermath, I don't think has been very persuasive. I think he's not really sure what to say, because I know he expected massive fraud. I mean, his campaign manager Volkov released a post like a few days before the voting that said, "We know there's going to be massive fraud, but that's the only thing that is inevitable at this point." He used the word inevitable over and over again. And when it turned out to be the case that there wasn't massive election fraud,
the operative word being massive, but it probably was fraud.
But that was the operative word in their post. It was specifically that there would be massive election fraud. There was even a metaphor Volkov used that the Kremlin doesn't have a scalpel; it only has a sledgehammer. And now it turns out, maybe they do have a scalpel.
They do have a scalpel.
They're not operating at all when it comes to vote counting. I mean, I don't think anybody's going to dispute that there are unfair irregularities and so on in the registration and the campaigning of all these elections and so on.
Right.
But when it comes to vote counting, I think it caught them off guard. I don't think their reaction was all that persuasive. I'm not sure exactly how this relates to the question of who won and who lost. But like I said, I do think that the election results are what they are, and the significance of them in the long term, in the medium term, for the big picture, it all depends on what people do now. And I don't think anybody's done anything that makes me think, "Oh wow, look at that guy. He's on the march to victory."
Well, no, I would say the strongest claim Navalny, and I think he has a legitimate claim to a recount. I will say that because, again, 32,000 votes, number one. Number two, I would say that the Popular Electoral Commission, their total shows Sabyanin below 50%. Golas says there were significant problems with the home voting. It looks like 80% of those who voted from home voted for Sabyanin. So there certainly appears to be enough that it merits looking at if this were a truly free and fair, totally transparent election?
Well, the 80%, I think this is something that I mean, it's technicality, but this whole election is just a big bag of technicalities. But the home voting 80% figure is pure speculation because the home votes themselves were counted with all the other votes. And so people are just running regressions on, okay, well, where there was a higher percentage of home votes, et cetera, et cetera. So it's all a guess. Nobody really knows.
But all I'm saying is that there is sufficient evidence that maybe this all should be looked at, given the fact that he got into a second round by 1.37% or 30%.
But you can't look. How do you look at home votes? They don't
tough to look
at home.
That's why they're arguing for a full recount.
In Navalny's complaints or whatever, I mean, I haven't actually read them, but it's apparently there's 50,000 pages of it, so I don't intend to.
He brought them in a truck. He posted his blog, too.
Right. But he did post like 7 main points. The first 4 have nothing to do with the vote counting. They involve administrative resources and unfairness in the campaigning. But the latter 3, one of them is home votes. But how that is a dispute that a court can take up, I don't understand, given that technically they don't exist anymore. They're mixed in with everything else. And even if you can prove the 80%, or even if you can sort of prove with a reasonable argument that 80% of them voted for Sibianin, what then? I mean, that's not fraud. That's just what happened. Now, maybe you could say, oh, well, they delivered them groceries and so on. But again, it's that's not counting fraud. I mean, like the count remains what it is. So I don't, not knowing the details of Russian campaign law, I don't know if any of that is grounds to actually force a recount. Again, forcing a recount, I'm not sure what that would accomplish, given that the votes are all mixed in together.
You can make Russian campaign law do anything you want.
Probably, sure.
It's so opaque. Sean, Mark, either of you want to weigh in on this before we move into other things?
I gladly will.
Okay.
I mean, actually, I think I agree that we should be careful about just getting involved in the nuts and bolts of whether or not there was fraud with the home voting and so forth. Because apart from the fact that as Kevin has said, we can't count them. I think also the demographic profile of the people who actually take advantage of the home vote are actually closer to the demographic profile of the people who vote for Sobyanin anyway. So even if that 80% pulled out of a hat and given a sort of a pseudo-scientific rationale figure is correct, it doesn't necessarily say that anything wrong has happened. But I think the key point to make is not, was this a truly and wholly fair election? Of course it wasn't. The point that it was actually the closest thing we've seen for a long time to a fair election in Russia, I think really is actually very significant. I mean, I think it's significant on several levels. One is it says something about what's going on within the Kremlin. Two, it says something about Sobyanin himself. I still don't regard him as the loser. Yes, of course, it doesn't give him irresistible momentum to go forward. But I think there is quite a significant political value in fighting a campaign, however badly, and winning barely rather than winning triumphantly but fraudulently. If we're really looking at the long game, in some ways there is definitely this internal political but also conceptual struggle taking place within the Kremlin. Do we actually try and operate within a massaged democratic structure? Or do we just remain fully authoritarian, not really go through the pretense? And you mentioned Ivanov. I mean, he's clearly in the camp that says, look, democracy must simply be a sham. Actually, what matters is the last, state power and that's it. Whereas Sobyanin, by, for example, supporting Navalny, still being on the ballot and such like, actually has aligned himself with the notion that actually we have to win through seeming to win some kind of a democratic mandate. So that is still powerful. And I think at the moment, whatever the weaknesses of his position, nonetheless, Sobyanin is the highest profile figure who is clearly standing for that wing of Kremlin politics. I think, again, to go back, it's very much, as Kevin said, it's now a question of what people do with this victory. If Navalny gets bogged down in arguing about whether or not the home vote count in a particular constituency was fair or not, he's missing the point.
I don't think he's missing the point.
Exactly. And I think, in a way, so nor should we. There's not going to be a sudden recount driven epiphany that leads to a second round or anything like that. It's all the question of, well, okay, where can Navalny go here? Because certainly what we now have, I think, is a situation in which the initiative is his.
Yeah.
You know, whereas up to now, the initiative has been the Kremlin. Now it's up to him to act, and we see what he does.
I mean, I'll say before we move on to the second part is that the mere fact that we're sitting here arguing about this minutiae, I think, is significant. Because, Mark, a week ago, we were on this podcast doing the pregame show, right? And here we are. And did you, in your wildest dreams, think in the postgame show we would have been arguing about Navalny came this close to a second round? I mean, did you really? I didn't think that. And I don't know anybody that was more bullish on his prospects in Moscow than I was.
Oh, no, there's no one more bullish. I agree. But the point is, again, that I think we have to realize that there is in some ways a strength in being seen as not having completely, fabricated results. People aren't really that bothered about whether or not, there are low-level, possibly systemic, massaging of votes. I mean, even if we look at the whole hanging Chad controversy in the United States, I mean, did it actually in any way impede the new president's ability to be a president? No. It was something that was fascinating for the political classes. It was a big story for a while. And then it just simply became part of political history and myth. Well, I mean, I think so too in this case. We should realize, A, not to get bogged down in the detail, but B, the fact that I still think, in the long run, here and now, Sobyanin is no doubt bleeding and smarting, but in the long run, it could actually be very much to his credit and to his strength that he actually fought a pretty, by Russian standards, very fair election, mm-hmm. and allowed it to be that close.
Well, and as something you said last week that really got me thinking a lot this week is that you think that when this election is over, Sobyanin and Navalny might turn out to be natural allies, given where Sobyanin is in the elite and who his enemies are and what Navalny now brings to the table. And so that's a pretty as good as any of a segue into the second half of our program, where we'll continue in a few moments. We'll continue our discussion of the fallout of the September 8th elections and ask how much has this changed the game for good. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me in the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the must-read blog In Moscow Shadows. And from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the excellent Sean's Russia blog. And also joining us via Skype from Storrs, Connecticut is Kevin Rothrock, project editor for Rusnet Echo at Global Voices, author of the great blog A Good Treaty, and an indispensable observer of the Russian blogosphere. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
What has happened? The old political system has died. It simply doesn't exist anymore. Look at what has happened here in Moscow and in Yekaterinburg. What happened in these two huge cities isn't connected to existing structures, parties, organizations, or former political leaders. It is connected to the activities of absolutely new people. Neither Navalny nor Roizman have a party. They don't need them. We can tell all our political parties and the political leaders who have been telling us how to live, thanks, guys, you can leave now. A new era has come.
That was liberal politician Leonid Gozman speaking on Dozh TV on election night, saying rest in peace to the current political system. And here's Navalny a day later on Bolotnaya Ploshchad seeming to agree with him.
Look at any party. Those guys with long faces who sit in the Duma and receive hundreds of millions and can't do anything. Here, people have united who just came off the street. They read an announcement, come to work on the election campaign. And they came. Look at yourselves. You don't all know each other. You have simply read, come and fight for your freedom. And you came and you fought. You came and fought so that we would win. so that we would be victorious. This isn't about Navalny. Tell me, who is the power here? We are the power here. We are the power here.
Mark, is the current political system dead, and is Navalny the new master of the new political reality?
No.
I knew you were going to say no, and I don't think so either. Well, I mean, I have a qualified answer to this, actually, but I want to hear what you think.
No, I mean, I think, first of all, if we talk about, is the current political system dead? Of course not. If nothing else, because...
Is it wounded?
It's wounded, and it's in potential evolution. I think, in a way, for me, the big issue is exactly that we have this shift, which is by no means guaranteed to proceed further. It could yet be stopped or reversed or whatever. But certainly this current shift towards trying to rule and legitimize Kremlin's control in a new way. The old notion was that they had these sort of systemic opposition parties, but they were not real parties. More to the point, they didn't really campaign. They were just simply about a certain amount of theater. Now there seems to be some willingness to accept the notion of a real opposition movement, accepting that actually, if nothing else, Russians are not so stupid as to continue to be fooled by the same game. It's a much more dangerous way of trying to legitimize yourself, because it involves giving power to someone like Navalny, who then can prove very, very able in what to do about it. But it can also actually be far, far more effective. I mean, I think what was clear is actually that the old system was definitely moribund. And therefore, there comes a question of either you double down, either you decide, no, we're going to be real proper authoritarians, actually sort of see their role model in Central Asia, which is sort of a ghastly concept, or they have to try and sort of move the other way and actually try and manage a process towards a certain limited democratization. It's an incredibly dangerous process. Very, very few authoritarian regimes manage to do that. But nonetheless, I think that is what the current shift in the Kremlin is. It's actually believing that they'll be able to do what so many others can't, which is to carefully bleed more democratic reality into the system, but in a managed way, and in a way that actually will therefore legitimate the system as a whole. We'll see if it works.
I think that's what they're trying to do, and Sean, I want you to weigh in on this. But in doing so, like you said, I mean, it seems if they bleed this into the system, they are going to lose their monopoly on power. This reminds me a little bit of perestroika. But if you bleed a little bit more legitimacy into the system in this environment, and if you want to know what do I think Navalny did, I chose that cut that we listened to for a reason. I wanted that bit where he said this isn't about Navalny, because in a lot of ways it isn't. This slow-burning revolution, as I wrote this week, has been happening for a while. This civil society has been maturing before our eyes. The Kremlin was worried about an orange revolution when a completely different kind of revolution was happening right under their noses. A new civil society was being born that's now beginning to network. And if you bleed power away from yourself in this atmosphere, or if you don't, I think there's really very little they can do to keep themselves in power right now, or at least keep themselves in a monopoly of power right now, given the current environment, given where society is moving. And it didn't just happen in Moscow. Yekaterinburg showed that this happens in a very different way, because Roizman's a very different kind of politician who appeals to a very different kind of constituency, but the same deal happened in Yekaterinburg. Sean, what do you think? Am I over the top optimistic again?
Well, you're always over the top optimistic, in my view. But I mean, if you take the Kremlin's words seriously, they've been talking about this for a long time. They've been talking about a very managed democratization. I mean, Putin said it, and I pointed this out in the article. Putin said it in April. He said, "Look, we can't to German television. We're not able to do. You know, you're expecting us to do what you and other countries have done that's taken 200, 300 years. You're expecting us to do this in 20. This is essentially what he's saying. And the Kremlin, I mean, managed democracy, if you think of it in a broader sense, they're managed democratization. This is, of course, if you take their word. And in some cases, you could put Sunday's election in that narrative. Now, I don't agree the system has completely changed. I don't actually agree that this network thing is really that prevalent. These are really isolated cases, because if you look at all the other elections, and I think there was 3,000 or something.
Yeah, United Russia cleaned house.
Russia cleaned house. They had no real challenge on the gubernatorial level. They had some challenge by the Communist Party in regional parliaments, but for the most part, I don't think they dipped below 40% in any of the kind of larger elections that I saw. So in this case, the party machine still worked, whatever that party machine may be, you know, strong arming, actually having offices and mobilizing people or mobilizing campaigns. This is still the model, and this is still what's going on. So now, granted, Moscow is incredibly important. Yes. But I think this is why they actually need more legitimacy in Moscow, because this is the key point of the Kremlin's power. It resides in Moscow because of the importance of the city. Absolutely.
Now, one point is, if you take the Kremlin at their word, and yes, they've been talking about this managed transition to democracy and how it's going to take a long time in Russia because we have no civil society and yada, yada, yada. At this point, you know, maybe that argument had a little bit of weight in the 90s or the early 2000s. It doesn't have as much weight right now because we are seeing it. It's not just in Moscow. It's across Russia. Look at the response to the forest fires in the summer of 2010, for example. Look at things like, you know, the YouTube cop. I mean, all the things that were happening mm-hmm. in the run-up to December 2011. I wrote a post called The Other Russia about this, about how this trickle and trickle and trickle of civic activity built and built and built and built into critical mass, and what happened in December 2011 shouldn't have surprised anybody. Mm-hmm. This is a continuation of that. This is a slow, long game. I don't think this regime is going to fall tomorrow, but I think it's moving on its way out, and something else is moving in to take its place. We don't know what kind of form that's gonna take yet, and it's now time for Kevin to rein me. Or do you want to make another point?
Yeah, just one last point. If you listen to from the Kremlin's perspective, they'll tell you that they created the conditions for this civil society to develop. Don't have to buy this. You don't have to buy this argument, and I don't buy it either. But it's more about the mentality of the ruling elite and how they proceed to engage in politics. Yes, they're responding to a lot of pushback. The reforms in I think it was February, March 2012, before Putin formally returned to the office, they were forced to accelerate that. They were forced to buy the protests.
But then they pulled back. Then they cracked down. Then we had Thermidor.
But who did they crack down against?
They tried to crack down against Navalny.
They tried.
They failed miserably.
But most of the crackdowns were against marginals. Mm. You know, for the most part. They cracked down on the radical left.
Yeah.
And they certainly went against Navalny, absolutely. But they pulled back so far. We don't know what's going to happen.
NGOs they cracked down on.
Again, yeah, absolutely. They're going to crack down on
sexual minorities.
On marginals. I mean, you know, this is the way I see it. So they're trying to whether they're doing clumsy or not is a different question. The thing is I'm trying to point out this is the mentality that they're working from.
This is the mentality they're working from. But I'm one. And the other thing I would add, though, is also there are people in this system that do take this managed transition to democracy seriously. Again, Sean, for the 100th time, as you and I were both writing about in the run up to the castling. When we thought, well, this is where this appears to be where they're taking it. There are people in the system who, and it seems Volodin's come around to that, which is telling. Which is again going back to the point Mark made last week that Sobyanin and Navalny might be the two biggest allies. They might become great allies before all is said and done. Kevin, what's your take? What's happened to the system here? Has it been wounded? Is it metamorphizing? What do you see happening here? What trajectory do you see this taking now?
Well, I mean, we started this conversation with the comments that Gozman made on TV.
And you were clearly dying
TV
to react to those.
what I wanted to highlight was what he said near the end of his appearance, which is that he drew attention to the fact that the Moscow mayoral campaign had become soaked in kind of xenophobic nationalism, and he said that everybody but the communist candidate had actually picked up this theme and run with it in a kind of disgraceful way. And that's the, one of the main attacks made on Sobyanin by all of the opposition candidates was that he was someone from outside, and he has, you know, he has Asiatic features, and that this is perhaps he didn't follow through and say this, but the way I read this sort of is logically consequent is that this is the sort of brave new world that we can await in the more democratic Russia. Now, I think that one of the ways that I understand the sort of slew of anti-NGO, anti-gay, anti-internet stuff that have come out of the Duma recently is I think that the Kremlin sort of sat down, people in the Kremlin sat down, and they said to themselves, well, there's all this civil society people that are telling us that that we're not democratic and that we don't represent the people, and they decided to give them a taste of what maybe populism would taste like if it involved more than just say the Moscow intelligentsia or the Moscow creative class or however you want to identify them. For instance, with the gay stuff, let's say that one interpretation is that the Kremlin is riling up the masses with an issue that doesn't really resonate with them, with an issue that they wouldn't have been thinking about on their own. And so they're responsible for increased levels of violence against homosexuals and so on and so forth. It's a perfectly valid interpretation, but I think it's also a competing explanation is that that Russian culture is intensely homophobic, that when you pass a law like this, you actually please and a lot of the people that then vote for you or that then have an opinion in an opinion poll about the direction of the government or so on. So I do think that that yes, there have been changes in the way Russian politics works since the protests, and there has been this sort of opening up. But I don't think that it's the sort of rise of the enlightened civil society that will then sort of negotiate a moderate form of politics. I think that Navalny is also, while he's in part a member of this intelligent, creative class, he's also tapping into the populist sentiments.
Oh, he certainly is, and that's one of his greatest strengths, is that he's been able to unify these two wings of the opposition, as we've talked about many times in this podcast.
It's one of his greatest strengths as a politician, but it's not a strength insofar as the narrative is that civil society is improving the sort of Russian body politic. I don't think there's a sort of a clear normative undertone of that story, and I think it misses a lot. I think it misses the sort of nastiness that we're in for if kind of expanded politics leads into populism. And Gozman's piece says that I wonder how the Kremlin will respond. Will they have to bring in another person like Rogozin? And if Rogozin is the sort of rational response, or if Navalny isn't that far from Rogozin in lots of ways, then like what are we really talking about here? It's going to be really interesting. I'm looking forward to it. But I get kind of queasy when the narrative starts to sound too kind of heroic and Hollywood-like.
Well, I mean, heroic. I mean, is it improving the body politic? That remains to be seen for sure. Is it changing the body politic? Undoubtedly. And as Russia watchers, one of the things we are interested in is how is it changing it? And it does seem to be that this monopoly on power that this group has enjoyed until now seems to be coming to an end. Where it's going to go after that? What kind of a player Navalny's going to be when he's in the system, if and when he ever gets real power? And I do think, I mean, I think he obviously has his eyes on a prize much larger than the mayor's office of Moscow. I think it's probably he's probably lucky he didn't win this just yet. But I think he has a very realistic shot at attaining that goal. So I think this really merits watching. The concerns you're raising are certainly legitimate. Navalny brings together many different strands of the opposition, strands that we civil society types like, and strands that we are not so comfortable with.
Well, for instance, Julia Latinina had a piece in Nova Gazeta where she hailed the election. She thought they were fantastic, and she said that it's good that Navalny. I might be confusing what she argued with someone else's piece, but essentially she was sort of agreeing with you, I think, saying that it's good that it ended up the way it is because you shouldn't push Putin into a corner. If you push Putin into a corner, there'll definitely be a crackdown. If you give him the room of interpretation if you give him the room to say, well, Sobyanin won, that's the end. I mean, what more do we need from this? There won't necessarily be a crackdown. There'll be kind of, if you leave him enough. If you leave him enough of that room, then Navalny can win, but then Putin won't crack down, etc. So, I mean, that I think is one way to take it, certainly.
No. Navalny, in his speech on Bologna, one of the things Navalny said is he's going to repeat this model that he just test drove in Moscow in other cities.
It makes no sense. The whole campaign is surrounded around his persona, his charisma. I mean, anybody in his campaign staff, none of those people are politicians. Ashurkov, Volkov, I mean, Ashurkov is a soft-spoken economist, basically, and Volkov is a very strange man, I think. He has a lot of wild ideas, and a lot of people have complimented the way he ran the campaign. And certainly, mobilizing the volunteers the way they did was innovative. Taking Navalny out to the people was very bold, and everybody respects that. But a lot of the things that came out on his blog and the statements that he made are kind of corrosive and conspiratorial, and I think he's a very strange man. He also said on the eve of the elections that he wishes Roizman luck, but he wouldn't vote for him. And this is a guy from the same place, right? He's from Ekaterinburg. What does that say for this national strategy if the other opposition guy who won? His campaign manager didn't even endorse him. I mean, Navalny wished him luck too. So, for all I understand, Navalny did endorse him more or less. He implied that he would vote for him. But Volkov, potentially one of the closest people to Navalny, said he wouldn't. I just don't see where this is headed. Navalny's talking about a national campaign, but he's the only name in his campaign, despite any attempts that he makes in his speeches to say, "Oh, this isn't about me; it's about us." The way I read that is, when he talks about us, he means the people who support me. We're all together, and we're going to lead the opposition now. But I just don't understand how that could be a national movement. A presidential campaign, sure, like you've said, he could make a run for that. All you need is one name for that. But a national campaign, I do not see it.
Well, I mean, what I see in terms of this model, and it's not about Volkov or anything like that. It's more about what they did. They basically targeted where their votes are, found them, and mobilized them. That's a modern political campaign. They did a classic outsider campaign. I mean, he famously told the New York Times he used the mayoral campaign in the TV series The Wire as his model. I also saw shades of Obama 08 in this campaign.
The two shows that he said that he took lessons from were The Wire and House of Cards. So that kind of worries me as an American who's seen both of those shows.
Well, The Wire was the campaign for mayor, which was an interesting storyline. But but I also saw shades of Obama 08 and Howard Dean 04 in this campaign. If you can bring another American analogy and classic outsider challenges to the establishment. I mean, he used that model of using what you can do given what you can't do. The voter mobilization, the use of the volunteers, the vote targeting. This all worked really well. Let's bring Mark and Sean. I'd like to get you two in here.
I think this, again, based on what Kevin just said, the two things. One is the personalization of the phenomenon of Navalny, I think, is something to really be concerned about, because if it is indeed so personalized, then it's really not so much different than Russian politics, the way governance works there already, a very personalized, informal network system. And if Navalny is taking part of his cues from the House of Cards, which is an amazing show, but what does it show? It shows politics, and maybe this is because I just finished reading Elena Ledeneva's book on informal governance. The problem of Russia is not individuals, it's systema. It's the system of informal practices of a relation, personal and networks. Now, if Navalny wants to break into that sistema, if he wants to go further, he might have to break into that, because this is the only way in the Russian system how you can climb to power. It's only been in rare instances where individuals have shot through. And if he gets into the Sistema, if you follow Edineva's model, he's corrupted if he gets into the system. Because part of this, what the system is it traps you. I mean, she interestingly ends her book by saying that Putin is a captive of this very system himself. So I think when we speak about this kind of rising crescendo of the bright future with Navalny riding the wave, I think we should remember that Russia is a very, very complex system of various informal networks that really are the basis and the foundation of what we see Russia today.
And I think this is one of the key things that is going to be happening. I mean, it's been quiet for a few days, and I think it's been quiet because I think they've been talking. I think they're negotiating right now. I'm not sure where Navalny is going to take this. He does. I think he has an opportunity to enter the system if he wants it. I'm not sure if he wants that or if he thinks he can ride this wave from the outside to power. If he wants to get in. I mean, it's what Volodin seemed to be offering him a few months back or a month or so back was the being the main center right oppositionist that's anointed by the regime. That would be interesting to watch because I'd really be interested in seeing how Navalny behaved in that kind of a situation. Like I said, this isn't Zhirinovsky. This isn't Mironov. This isn't Zhuganov. This isn't going to. Will he be housebroken? Is an interesting, or can he ride this from the outside? And, you know, I would not dismiss that out of hand. He would be the first one ever to do that since Lenin. There hasn't been anybody that's come in from outside since Lenin. Everybody else has come in from the inside. Mark, well, I'd actually like you to weigh in on this. I mean, what are Navalny's next moves? What are the Kremlin's next moves?
If we're going to look at, I mean, you drew the comparison with Lenin. Lenin was able to seize power because basically the regime had already collapsed. Power was lying in the streets ready for him to pick up. And he had this sort of core of, for want of a better word, disciples. You know, highly disciplined, highly motivated, willing to follow, which in some ways is what Navalny has got. He has his kind of, you know, inner core of groupies and followers. And as Kevin has said, you know, this is still a monstrously personalized movement. In terms of the position, because Navalny is an insurgent, and if he's going to remain an insurgent rather than precisely be brought into the system and in that respect be house trained, the role of an insurgent is always to very, very clearly demarcate himself from the status quo. And in that respect, actually, in an exaggerated way. So, you know, going back to the earlier points about the dangers of quite what we'll see of a sort of democracy red in tooth and claw, of potential for populism, for racism, for all kinds of other unpleasantisms, is exactly what Navalny needs to decide how he's going to position himself. Now, focusing on corruption makes sense on a variety of levels. First of all, it gives a sort of common cause that a lot of ordinary Russians can agree with. And secondly, it clearly positions himself against the elite, against the Sistema. And thirdly, it's one of these wonderfully open things. You know, who is actually going to ever speak out in favor of corruption? But he can then precisely define who he's aiming at, what kind of corruption and such like. You know, is it big business, or is it a traffic cop stopping you for your papers or whatever? That's well and good. If he's going to push that, though, into national presidential level politics, he's basically declaring war on the elite.
Yes.
Now, Lenin didn't mind doing that, to go back to that parallel. Lenin was quite happy to have people shot or imprisoned. And Lenin was in a situation in which the state had already, to a large extent, exhausted its capacities to suppress him. Now, Navalny's going to be in a situation in which actually, for all the internal divisions and weaknesses of the state, it certainly still has those capacities. I mean, let's be blunt. The state, as you said, let Navalny campaign. State let Navalny stand. They could have just simply said, nope, sorry, you're a convicted criminal. There's no way this is happening. I mean, there's all kind of ways in which they can target him. Or, to be honest, if they were being sharper, I think they would start targeting the people around him. How long before Shurkov gets a knock on the door or whatever. I think we have to realize that if Navalny really does want to continue to be an insurgent candidate, if Navalny is not positioning himself to find some suitable deal to be the midwife that slowly takes Putin's Russia towards a fairly democratic regime, but one in which the elite still protect their power, he's picking a war. And that is going to be, I think, quite a problematic and dangerous situation to be in.
Okay, well, if you're that's an excellent point. And if you're Navalny, if you're advising Navalny right now, do you advise him to be an insurgent or do you advise him to be a midwife? Because there are perils with both of those.
Mm-hmm.
What do you advise him to do?
Well, I mean, I think me, because
being
I am
a democratic guy that you are.
Yeah, but also being a coward, I would clearly go for the midwife option. No, but joking apart, I mean, I think, you know, and again, we go back to this point about Latinin's take. Actually, historically speaking, if you pick a straightforward stand-up fight with the Kremlin, you will probably lose personally in the sense that bad things will probably happen to you. But on the other hand, you will probably accelerate and exacerbate the collapse of this regime. The question is, in a way, how much collateral damage are you willing to let happen in the process? The good news is that actually, even if you act as the midwife and make people think that you're willing to be reasonable and rational, whatever, history is on your side. This kind of regime always falls. So in some ways, I would say, rather than going for the sort of maximalist approach, which is actually simply going to empower the Ivanovs of this world, give options, give scope, give people within the elite who are not Putin the chance to think, well, we might have to jettison the big guy, but nonetheless, we're going to be all right. That's what's really going to shatter this.
And on Bolotna, Navalny himself seemed to be struggling with this himself, or with the part where he said, you probably expect me to tell you to stay on the square and to light fires and turn over cars, but I'm not going to do that right now. I'm not going to put you in danger, but someday I might. But trust me, I know what to do next. Does he know what to do next, do you think, or is he still working this out?
I'm sure he's still working this out. I think for me, that was actually one of the most interesting and also actually most alarming points when he was more or less suggesting to them, look, I don't want you to be violent and criminal now, but I may require you or expect you to be violent and criminal. Firstly, because, again, what it says about his own understandings of democracy. And this is the bad news. Democrats have to play by the rules. I mean, it's like, you know, we go back to the parallel of The Wire. One of the interesting points about The Wire is it raises exactly the issue of how far in the name of catching bad guys do you basically break the rules yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And actually just how corrosive morally, politically, and so forth that is. So we've moved away from Lord of the Rings onto The Wire.
Yes, this is great. Without Kirill, we're talking about The Wire. This is, I still haven't gotten a Mad Men reference in this damn podcast.
But the final point is that, I mean, again, it's this sense of trust me as an individual. I know what to do. I will tell you what needs to be done in due course. Again, that is still very much playing to this notion that essentially everyone's role is to be an extra in the grand movie of Navalny's rise.
And as we wrap up, I'll give the last word to Kevin. Same question I gave earlier to Mark, but do you see Navalny going more what Mark described as the midwife route going into the system or the insurgent route?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. I think that the fact that his at his rally, let's say on the 9th, I guess it was, when he did make this sort of threatening implication that, you know, maybe next time he's going to call people to turn over cars and light fires and so on. And I think and I already saw, I think Leontov on Первый канал was already cited this in an excerpt to show, you look at him, he's a violent man. Navalny's obviously weighing his options, and one of those options, I think it's clear he realizes, is a sort of slower approach that will not involve relying on his ability to put people in the streets. Because ultimately, in part, I suppose, because of what the argument that Latinina makes about don't put Putin in a corner, I think he understands that he can't win in that fight. But the problem, I think, will be, as I've already said, is that I don't really see a mass movement that could be built around him yet. And the main reason for that is because his ideology, whatever it is, and people want to put him in various camps, but he's clearly not in any one. There's some that he's definitely not in, but is he a nationalist? Is he a liberal? Yeah, he's a bit of that. He's a bit of this. there's nothing about his ideology that seems to attract people necessarily. It's who he is. It's what he represents sort of as a symbol. And it's not necessarily for any of his ideas. And that is a problem when you want to build a mass movement, I think. Because who are the people he's going to put in this movement? What are going to be the reasons that people are going to support it? There are reasons to support him for the things he's done as an individual, for his ability to speak and so on. But I just don't know where it's supposed to go. I mean, it's not without promise. There's possibilities that there's a possibility he can build something out of this. I just don't see evidence of it yet, but it'll be interesting to see what he can do. And if he does go to jail, a lot of people now are saying that with this turnout, they can't put him in jail. I don't believe that. They can put him in jail.
I don't think they will, though. I don't think that's where it's going.
I don't know. I mean, as Navalny said, I don't think they've decided yet. And I think I agree with that. I don't think they've decided yet. But if we assume they do put him in jail, what does that do to the movement? I'm not sure. I was actually taken aback that he didn't let his wife speak at all.
I was surprised by that as well. Actually,
because
maybe
she
didn't want to.
Maybe she didn't. Maybe he didn't want her to. But who better to sort of to help in this campaign than his wife? As I understand, she's very well spoken. She's intelligent, just like he is. Why not have her get involved? I don't know why not. In general, I just don't know where this is supposed to go from now.
I mean, my expectations right now, for what it's worth as we wrap up, is that I think he's going to take this political capital that he just earned and he's going to leverage it to get the best deal as possible to I don't like the word get in the system, but he's living to fight another day. Maybe he's been offered to be, you know, have some kind of anointed, sanctioned, blessed center right option that the regime's going to think it's going to control. I think he's looking at the Moscow Duma elections coming up in a year's time, and I think he can do quite well in those elections.
So do you think they're not just going to suspend his sentence? You think they're going to exonerate him? Because doesn't he need to be exonerated to be able to run an office? If he's convicted even on an Uslovny sentence, he's not eligible for elected office.
Yeah, and it depends on the calculations that are coming from the authorities. I mean, if they think that he could be more dangerous if they push it, because that's going to leave him no other option than the insurgent route, which, yes, they would crush him, but he can do a lot of damage.
Even you're saying even a suspended sentence leaves him only the insurgent.
Yeah.
Route.
What else does it leave him? He can't run for office.
But he says he has this movement. Well, let's see what that looks like, because he doesn't need to run himself on every ticket, right? So in theory, he still has options.
Yeah,
so
in theory, he still has options.
So if he resorts to relying on the street, then that would seem to be proof that, oh, you actually don't have a mass movement, do you? This is all you've got.
Right. No, this is all tentative, of course. I'm expecting I'm expecting exoneration, but I'm expecting them to try to bring him into the system. I think he's earned political capital that I think he's going to try to leverage right now. We got Moscow City Duma elections coming up in a year's time, and I think he can do quite well in those elections. And then he'll have a power base in the city council of the capital, and maybe a very significant power base. I mean, wouldn't it be something if he had Sobyanin as mayor of Moscow and Navalny as speaker of the city Duma, right, for example? Now, that's a long shot, but hell, last week I said he was going to get 25%, and that was supposed to be a long shot, right? Then you got state Duma elections coming up a year after that, and then the big prize. I mean, I think he's thinking in that way, step by step, and at each step of the process, he takes a little bit more legitimacy away from the regime.
Well, that's one way to describe it. But using the same rationale, you could also say he's making it up as it goes. And one of them sounds like a compliment; the other one doesn't.
Well, I think everybody right now is making it up as they go, because we are certainly in uncharted territory, and that, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. And from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. And also joining us via Skype from Storrs, Connecticut, my home state, is Kevin Rothrock, project editor of Runet Echo at Global Voices and author of the blog A Good Treaty. Thanks, as always, for the interesting and provocative discussion, gentlemen.
It's been fun.
Thank you.
And I would also like to thank our brilliant and astonishingly patient producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Russ Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.